6, State of New Hampshire versus Stephen Diamond, and the Chief Justice is not participating.
May it please the Court, I'm Joshua Gordon. I represent the defendant, Stephen Diamond. I also appear for the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. All the revered documents of our political system recognize that police power must be answerable to elected officials. UNH isn't a town and doesn't have selectmen. UNH's police department is not answerable to any elected official. It hangs untethered outside the political system. David Diamond, who is protesting against poor labor practices, cannot be held guilty by a police department that doesn't legally exist. In a normal situation, and this is government 101 I learned over at UNH, you know, in a normal situation, you can draw a line from a line of power from the officer to his chief, from the chief to the selectman of the town, from the selectman to the legislature, from the legislature to the Constitution to the social compact that validates our Republican form of government. So you have police power by consent of the governed. And that's not Government 101, that's Declaration of Independence material. But you can't draw this line for UNH officers. You go from consent of the governed to the Constitution, and from the Constitution to the legislature, but there the line breaks. UNH is not a town, and by statute, only towns can exercise arrest powers. If UNH's authority comes from its contract with Durham, governments have no power to delegate such core functions as depriving people's liberty, confiscating their things, or searching them. So in UNH's case, there is not the required direct and clear line from the consent of the governed to the arresting officer. And there's no doubt that there are two police departments in Durham. I'll take the indications one at a time. Hiring. Durham can't choose who UNH hires. Durham cannot use the hiring process to set its policies, policing policies, or priorities. Durham has only the ability to approve a person nominated by UNH. It's not even clear that Durham can decline approval. The contract says Durham shall deputize. Firing. Durham can't fire UNH officers. Firing can only be done with the town gown committee approval comprised, at least in part, of UNH personnel. Employment. The distinguishing feature of an employment relationship is the employer's right to benefit from and direct the performance of an employee's labor and the commensurate duty or right by the employee to his wages. There is no such relationship between the town of Durham and UNH police officers. Pay and benefits. UNH officers get paid by UNH, not Durham. They get UNH insurance and benefits. They follow UNH grievance procedures, not Durham's. They are in UNH's pay scales. They follow UNH's policing practices. They get employee evaluations by UNH, not Durham. They're disciplined by UNH, not Durham. They even wear badges that say UNH are provided by UNH, not by the town of Durham. Durham and UNH police departments have completely separate operations. They each have their own letterhead, offices, and phone number. They each use their own equipment, guns, and cruisers. They each have their own separate budget. There are two police chiefs in Durham, each commanding his own allegiance from his officers, and each responsible for his own department. And each chief has a separate command. The Durham chief cannot command UNH officers to do anything, not even polish their boots and put on their badges. In a police organization which depends upon rank and command structure, the inability, Durham's inability to command UNH officer belies any claim that the UNH department is somehow a subset of the Durham force.
Well, Mr. Gordon, let me just ask you a question. Do you concede that the evidence supports the district court judge's finding that these two officers, the officer was actually appointed by the chief and actually as a Durham police officer and actually sworn in by the town clerk?
He was properly deputized. Oh, sure.
And what you're trying to say is that because there's a contract between the town and the university, which the district court judge said it wasn't up to him at that instance to interpret or even to determine if it's applicable or if it violates public policy, that the police officer thereby somehow has less police power than some other police officer who's sworn in as a police officer because of a contract that may or may not be valid?
Not quite. Like I said, the arrest power is a big thing. It has to be provided for somehow. And the statutes say the towns can exercise it. Statutes don't say UNH can exercise it. So UNH gets it from this contract. But governments can't delegate their power of arrest. They can delegate the authority to plow the street or fix a fence, but they can't delegate the arrest power.
To whom do you say the town delegated the power of arrest? The power of arrest was given to the police officer by virtue of an appointment of the police chief.
But in order to exercise that, there has to be a police chief who superintends all the officers, and there isn't that because the town of Durham has no control over this officer. He was deputized, and, you know, the seal was sealed and the signature was signed, but he has no, the police department itself has no legitimate authority.
Well, what if the Durham police chief went up to the university on a Friday afternoon and said, by the way, I'm restructuring everything. You're all coming down to the Durham Police Department, and here's how we're going to run things. Presumably, UNH would say, well, you can't do that because of the contract. Then sooner or later, somebody's going to have to determine whether that contract violates public policy, whether the town could, in effect, do whatever it did in the contract. We don't know that the police chief in the town of Durham can't tomorrow exercise control over every single person who he named and who was sworn in by the clerk of the town of Durham, do we?
I think we do. I think the facts in the record show it, and I think the law without the facts show it. That the supposing an officer did something that the Durham chief didn't like, what authority does the Durham chief have to command this officer? He can't fire him. He can't even cut his pay. He can't demote him. He's got no authority. This officer is not answerable to the chief. This officer is answerable to the University of New Hampshire.
Would you feel any differently if this complaint had said that what the defendant failed to do was obey a lawful order of a Durham police officer?
This has to do with the arrest itself,
you're saying he's not arrested by a Durham police officer.
He's arrested by a UNH police officer with a UNH badge and all that sort of thing.
Why aren't they de facto officers? State made some pretty good arguments on those lines.
Yes, which I tried to answer in my reply brief. There, you cannot have a de facto officer without a de jure office. And this case attacks the existence of the office, not the officer.
Well, they have a de jure office in the sense, as Justice Mayer was pointing out, they were appointed by the chief and sworn in, took the oath. So they can arrest. Can't they arrest in the town of Durham, New Hampshire? Or can they only arrest on campus?
Probably they can arrest in the town of Durham, but my contention is that they can't arrest at all. So,
They're appointed. They're sworn in. Like every officer who works every day in the Durham Police Department is appointed the same way and takes the same oath.
RSA 101.
Why aren't the jury officers in this context at least de facto?
RSA 105 provides that there has to be one chief, the chief has to be able to superintend and supervise, that the badges have to come from the town. You know, these are a separate police department. This is two separate police departments with two separate command structures and two separate everythings. And, you know, whether or not they can cross lines has to do with, according to Chief Kurz, who testified, interdepartmental cooperation. But this isn't a case where someone was improperly authorized, you know, with the old case, I think, Jewel, where there wasn't a seal on the warrant or something like that. This is a case where the office of UNH Police Force, UNH Police Department, does not exist.
Because
the statute says
the contract is void?
Well, the statute says that Durham or towns may have police chiefs.
But they delegate it by contract.
You can't delegate the supposing the Durham.
Why can't you delegate the police power?
It's a core function that you can't delegate to any old person.
Where does this Constitution say it can't be delegated?
Well, there are some cases I cited in my brief that say so. One from Ohio. It is a very rarely litigated issue. But
states delegate, you know, prison administration, lots of different things these days. And so, I mean, I just don't quite understand where it is in the Constitution that it's prohibited for a state or a town to delegate. The statute says they can make a contract that's necessary and convenient.
Yes, and I think the necessary and convenient is for things like plowing the police station parking lot, but I don't think it extends as far as delegating the power to arrest. If the Newington Mall wanted its own security guard, could the town of Newington delegate to the Newington Mall the powers of arrest?
What would prohibit it?
There has to be some connection between the person making the arrest and the, up the ladder to the consent of the government.
Well, it's a contract.
But you can't.
That's the connection.
This court might not agree with me, but my contention is that you can't delegate such a core function as the power to arrest. You can delegate things like plowing and buying statements and things like that, but the government, it's an executive function, quite clearly an executive function, and not a private function.
Where do they derive the power to arrest?
From statute. Or where does who derive it?
When did they first achieve the power to arrest? Wasn't it the day they were sworn in as police officers for the town of Durham, New Hampshire? Then they went to work over at UNH. They had the power to arrest the day they were sworn in. They exercised it while working on the campus, didn't they?
Two arguments. One, the delegation is not proper. And second, because of RSA 105, provides for, requires that there be a direct line of command from the police chief in Durham, the Durham chief, to the officer, which doesn't exist.
I understand that. What I'm quarreling about at the moment is the power to arrest. Their power to arrest does not arise under this contract. Their power to arrest arises from the fact that they are selected by the chief and sworn in as police officers in the town of Durham. They are then invested with the power to arrest. Where they exercise that power is an issue, but it didn't arise from a contract.
Well, I think the two things
are... Not like they hired me to work on the police force on UNH and I was never selected by the town as an officer. I might agree with you then.
I feel those two things are intertwined, at least in my mind, because the existence of the UNH police force there would be no police force without their contract. The contract, in effect, creates the police force.
Well, you don't think the chief of the town of Durham could swear in 12 police officers and appoint them, have them sworn in by the clerk, and say, "I'm sending you over to the university. We're going to call you the university officers."
And thereby,
it's a delegation of the right to arrest to a university.
It's not delegation. It's a wholesale giving away. Once that's happened, then the police chief in Durham has no control over that officer. Can't look at his or her driving logs, can't superintend or supervise in any fashion. They can't fire them, they can't raise their pay, they can't do anything.
So it's the delegation of administrative duties that's troubling you? The chief is delegating his administrative duties to the university to set when they're going to show up for work, how they have to dress, how they're going to get paid?
No, I think delegation is, there's a difference between delegation and contracting away. It's contracting away. It's not delegation. Once given, it's irrevocable. And yes, I think that's a little bit of what's troubling me, but this delegate or this giving away of police power is something that ought not be done. It's something that once done can't be taken back because these people have guns. It's not likely to happen, but it has the potential for a very scary set of circumstances, and it's why I brought in a movie in my brief, because it makes out that point, how it, once the foot is under the door, then it can go that way. Government should not give away its power to arrest. That's a scary thing.
I just having trouble following. Where did they derive their power to arrest?
From
the UNH Police Department?
Who's the they?
The officers in this case. They derive their power to arrest where?
They don't derive it.
They have no power to arrest.
They have no power of arrest. The statute says towns may have police departments. In this case, UNH has a police department. They claim this power is a matter of deputization from Durham. But Durham has no power to give police power to a different department.
But these officers were selected by Durham, sworn in by Durham.
No, they were selected by UNH.
Well, the police chief accepted them.
Yes.
Right? So he could have said no.
Well, no, he can't say no. The contract says shall deputize. It says shall. It means it gives the Durham police chief absolutely no discretion. Shall deputize. So they don't work for UNH. For Durham. Durham has no power over these people. May I address one additional issue that was raised in the state's brief? In the obstructing charge, he was. There's. You can. The obstructing statute, if you act with force, violence, intimidation, or other illegal act in obstructing, that makes up the charge. He was charged, Mr. Diamond was charged with an unlawful act. We tried three times the state was specific in response to a bill in particular, and twice in response to motions to dismiss. Three times the state was specific that the unlawful conduct charge was based on the disorderly and obstructing statutes. Three times the state said nothing about resisting arrest. What the state said then became the elements of the crime. The state can't change that now without depriving the defendant of his right to be apprised of the nature of the charges then. And the defendants can't be required to defend against every possible unlawful act that a creative appellate attorney can now dream up. And the state is stuck with the unlawful act that was charged below. The state's brief says that, well, the unlawful act that was sort of came up through the disorderly statute is based on resisting arrest. That was not mentioned at trial. If it was mentioned at trial, the defendant would have defended on it. He was not apprised of those charges. And the line of argument that the state relies on to say, well, you know, now we can come up with this resisting arrest thing is not applicable. That would be akin to a faulty indictment.
So was there an argument, or was there discussion, either closing arguments or when the verdict was reached, about what the unlawful act was, whether it was disorderly conduct or resisting arrest?
The state raised it three times. One, in bill particulars, they responded with the recharging, and the recharging put unlawful act. Then in response to one of defense's motions to dismiss, the state said that the unlawful act they're talking about was disorderly conduct, and that's where they stopped. And I made an argument brief that becomes a circular argument. In the state's brief now, the unlawful conduct that they hope to bootstrap with is resisting arrest. Resisting arrest was never mentioned below. If they thought of resisting arrest, they would have just charged them with resisting arrest, which probably the facts may have. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ann Rice. I represent the state in this appeal. And I would be happy to take questions from the court at the outset of my argument if you're so inclined. The basic issue for this court is whether the two officers that were involved in the defendant's arrest had the legal authority to execute an arrest. And they did. Both of the officers were duly appointed by the Durham police chief. They were sworn in by the town clerk. They were authorized to act as police officers, at least within the confines of the UNH campus. That is where the arrest occurred, and they were acting pursuant to that authority.
Well, how about the argument here that really what we have is two different police forces in the town of Durham? Each had their own chief, they each had their own protocols and administrative rules. And as Mr. Gordon was pointing out, the lines of authority are somewhat blurred at the higher level, too.
I agree. The lines are blurred somewhat at the higher level. But I do want to make clear, defense counsel said that the Durham chief of police has no discretion in terms of accepting a UNH police officer and deputizing him. That's not correct. The agreement says that the chief shall deputize qualified officers, which means that the Durham chief of police could reject an officer if he didn't believe that the officer
But are there two police forces in Durham, New Hampshire?
There are two administrative structures, but I think that that's different than two police forces. All of the power of arrest comes from the town of Durham and the selectmen. No one can act as a police officer unless they are sworn in, they are deputized by the chief of police and sworn by the town clerk.
Are they required to complete the police standards training council like other police officers?
I believe they are now, Your Honor. That's not part of the record, but it's my understanding that they are.
And if I want to discipline, I'm the chief of Durham, and I want to discipline an officer who works up in the UNH office, can I do that?
I think day-to-day discipline is basically done by the UNH department itself. The chief of police does have the power to immediately revoke an officer's qualification, revoke a deputization, and to fire them. What the agreement says is that had the right to suspend the officer's police powers immediately for cause, to revoke the police powers for cause, with final revocation of the police powers to be made only after presentation of the reasons to a joint committee of the town and university.
Let me ask you on that point. If I'm the more traditional officer in the town of Durham and they want to fire me, who's involved in that?
It's not clear from the record. I would assume that the chief of police is the one that makes that ultimate decision, as he would for these officers.
Now, in connection with terminating the officers at UNH, it's not a direct line to the police chief. There's this commission or joint group that's involved.
What the contract says, and there was no evidence on this issue below, so I'm just sort of gleaning this from the record, but what it says is final revocation shall only be made after presentation of reasons to this joint town-university committee. So the chief makes the decision to revoke police powers and must present those reasons. It doesn't appear from the contract that committee has any veto power over that, but that there must be a presentation of reasons.
If it did, would that trouble you?
No, it still wouldn't trouble me, because for purposes of the issue in this case, the officers have the power of arrest from the town of Durham. That's the only place it can come from, and that's where it came from. So I think that I do agree that there may be some delegation of administrative responsibility. So that's what's been done in this case. But in terms of delegating the police power, it has not been delegated. It comes directly from the town of Durham.
Do some states create these university police forces by statute?
I am aware that there are some states that have done that, and that is something that's been considered in this state. I know that that's an issue that's been considered.
And of course, if these officers were not deputized and sworn in by the chief and the town clerk, you wouldn't have any argument at all that they could arrest anybody anywhere at any time. They would be just private security guards.
That's correct.
In your brief, you seem to concede that there's a problem with the de jure status of this. What is the scope of the concession? Are you conceding that the contract is, there's a problem with the contracting authority here? I don't quite understand.
I'm not actually conceding that there is a problem.
Assuming for sake of argument.
That's correct, and that's basically saying, without reaching all of the administrative issues that the defense has raised, that even if they were not acting as official officers, they were certainly de facto officers. So I'm not conceding any of those points, and I think that the argument on the de facto officer is so strong, in addition to the fact of where these officers got their power, that we didn't go into all the issues. I do think that there, you know, he raises some legitimate concerns, but we are certainly not conceding them.
So is it your position that the state can contract away the power to arrest?
I don't think the state can contract away the power to arrest.
Okay.
But I certainly do think it would be appropriate to delegate administrative responsibilities. I think that's appropriate.
But if they have this contract, then don't they have to retain some control?
If it is
a core function, as you seem to suggest, then don't they have to retain some control over the UNH police?
I think that the Durham chief has retained some control over the Durham police. Over the UNH police, in terms of he's the one that deputizes them, and he is also the one that makes the decision. He can suspend and revoke police powers. Now, day-to-day administrative stuff, it appears, is done by the UNH administrative ranks. But the Durham Chief of Police has not delegated his ultimate responsibility, and that's what the trial court found in this case.
Is it the state's view that these two officers in this case could arrest within the town of Durham off campus?
It is not clear from the record what the oath and the deputization, you know, the scope of that, but if they are sworn in as town officers, then it would be my position that they could do that. It's not clear from the record.
Does the contract address that?
No, I don't believe it does.
So their commissions by the town were not part of this, the record, whatever the oath the clerk administered and whatever was signed by the various officials just wasn't part of this record. It's conceded that they were named by the chief and sworn in by a clerk as Durham town officers. But the document that was actually signed is not part of the record?
No, it was never made part of the record. That point was conceded, and in fact it was conceded that the Durham chief of police has the power to deputize officers for UNH. I think that the objection goes to the administrative structure, which the discussion has been talking about.
Would they have qualified immunity? These police officers for UNH, do they have qualified immunity the way Durham police officers have immunity in civil litigation?
As town of Durham officers, I would believe that they would, but I'm not really prepared to respond to that any more than to say it would be my understanding that they would, because they are deputized as Durham police officers.
At some point where they become private parties, and then, you know, they don't have any governmental immunity if they're private parties.
They have never been perceived as private parties. These are always considered as state actors. I mean, they are fully deputized and certified police officers. They are a political subdivision. So I don't think that they could be seen as private parties in that role.
At some point, could the town so delegate away its administrative oversight that it would lose control of these officers? Or is there anything that could do administratively that would cover you? You say the day-to-day administration for these officers is with the UNH police chief.
I think I'm not really prepared to draw a line, but I think, you know, if the Durham police chief said, I will appoint these officers and then I have nothing else to do with them, I think that could be a little troublesome. But we certainly are not there. That's clear from the contract that we are not there, and that's what the trial court found. So the record establishes that these officers were operating under legal authority, but even if they weren't, I would move to the second argument, which is that they were de facto officers, and that this defendant, or any third party, is in no position to collaterally attack the validity of that title.
What about the defendant's second argument of respecting the unlawful act?
I have to admit, I don't recall seeing in the record an issue of bill of particulars. But if the state, I don't believe that I am changing the charge in any way. I'm still relying on the fact that the defendant committed the unlawful act of disorderly conduct by standing in front of this officer, purposely stepping in front of the officer, and then refusing to move, and in that way interfering with the arrest. So I have to admit that it took me somewhat by surprise, and I would have expected that would be in the reply brief so that I could have been prepared for that, but it was not. So I apologize. I can't refer to address that any further. If there are no further questions, I'll submit my brief.
Thank you. Case submitted. Thank you.